It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the pandemic has disrupted our routines over the last year, and for a lot of people, that's led to trouble sleeping. A UW sleep expert joins the show for a look at the problem and how we can set ourselves up for better rest. First, following George Floyd's death in police custody last year and the nationwide protests that followed, police accountability and reform have gotten a lot of attention here in Wisconsin. In August, Governor Evers released a package of policing-related bills for the legislature to consider. Those weren't taken up at the time, but a bipartisan speaker's task force was formed to review police standards and work on other ideas for police reform. And last week, state senators released a new package of 8 bills, including 7 with some bipartisan support. They would create a state board to review use of force incidents, ban chokeholds, and establish a community policing grant program, among other things. A sponsor of that legislation joins us now. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If police reform has been an important issue for you, what do you want to see change? What questions do you have about what these bills do and don't do? Do you think a state review of officer-involved use of force incidents is a good idea? If you've worked in law enforcement yourself, love to hear your perspective. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Van Wongert is a Republican representing the state's 21st Senate district, which includes Racine and Kenosha counties. He's a former law enforcement officer. Senator Wongert, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Hope you're doing well.
You too. Now, as a former law enforcement officer yourself, these are not new issues to you. What made you decide to put together this package of bills now?
Well, actually, this wasn't just determined when we had the Floyd incident or any of these recent issues that took the national spotlight. We've actually been working on reforms and dealing with some of the mechanics with law enforcement reform, well, since probably about 2015. I know the one bill we've been working on since at least 2015 is accountability through the creation of an independent use of force advisory board. We call it the Police and Community Safety Board. And that was actually brought to fruition as a result of a police-involved shooting in Kenosha. And Michael Bell, the father of a person who was killed as a result of that interaction, started working on this idea and brought it forward and modeling it after the National Transportation Safety Board. And we can always learn from incidents that occur, but it's important that we allow the process to work and that there be a good process in place. And we identified the fact that, you know, it's not just about finding fault or finding if somebody violated a rule or a regulation. It is about, I think, identifying if there's a problem in the process where maybe we erred or maybe it's an equipment issue, it's a training issue, or there's some other factor that got into the process or part of the process was skipped one or two steps, and that resulted in the negative results. So National Transportation Safety Board, they do just that. They come in and look at it, assess it, determine if the process was followed, if training was followed. Maybe training has to change because of different types of equipment and stuff that are available. So that's the idea behind that. And so we've been working on that for years. And because sometimes it takes a long time to get everybody that's got an interest in this to come to the table and chat about it. And we've had probably several hundred gatherings of people that have had an interest in this. In 2017, we actually had a conference at Wingspread in here in Wind Point at the S.C. Johnson Foundation, where we brought people in from all around the country to talk about this model being created. So this has been an ongoing thing, and it's finally to the point where we're going to get to fruition, I think, and we've got our police groups, we've got victims, we've got prosecutors, we've got defense attorneys, judges that have looked at this, so, and we've got support from both sides of the aisle, so I think we're on our way to getting this across the finish line.
And we've talked to Michael Bell a few times over the years, and he's talked about this aviation industry modeled incident review board. So who, talk us through the practical side of it in your legislation. What would this board look like? What would they do?
Well, what the board would do is we would would have a board that would be notified. Same thing, if there was an officer involved shooting there where there was death or great bodily harm occurred as a result of law enforcement interaction, generally the Department of Justice is notified right away, and quite often the DOJ comes in and does an immediate investigation as to what's happening. Or it could be the sheriff from the adjoining county comes and initiates that. We changed the statutes just a couple years ago that actually makes it current law that if you have a death or something which is a officer involved shooting, that you can't investigate it yourself, your own department. It's got to be done by another organization. So it's not, you know, the one department investigating itself from the standpoint of determining whether or not there was fault by the officer involved in that event. So what this would do is this would have a group of people on a board that have an expertise in all different areas. Could be dealing with training issues, could be dealing with mental health issues, officers that have worked in the field or trained in the field, experts in their area that would be able to respond to a call like that within a relatively short period of time, 4 to 6 hours. A group of experts would respond to that event, and once the scene has been processed by the original officers doing the investigation, they'd be also reviewing and documenting what they see and interviewing people that were witnesses and victims involved in this process. But this group of experts and individuals that would be doing this would be individuals that are not looking to be judgmental. They're not doing this because they're trying to identify fault, quote-unquote, whether it's civil or criminal. They're there to look at what happened. What was that continuum that got to a point where lethal force was used and ultimately an officer responded to that call for service by using lethal force. And so that would be their main push would be to determine the process. And where do we need to adjust that process that potentially we can eliminate this happening again, happening someplace else? You know, because maybe it's a training issue. Maybe it is too many hours that an individual's been working. Maybe they want to work in double or triple shifts because of circumstances. Could be that there's drugs or alcohol involved on either side of the equation. A lot of times that's what we're running into now in law enforcement is there's such a huge misuse of methamphetamines and codeines and fentanyl and all these other illicit drugs. I mean, just the issue that happened in Minneapolis and the one that happened in Kenosha, both of those individuals that were the result of that reaction by officers were both heavily inundated in fentanyl. And so that was a big, big problem. So officers need to be able to identify these things, and hopefully maybe there's some other things that we can do to de-escalate the situation.
Talking to Wisconsin State Senator Van Wongert about a new package of police-related legislation, a number of pieces of which have some bipartisan support so far. We focused on this incident board. There's a whole lot more going on in this package of legislation. What other things did you highlight?
Well, you know, I think, you know, mandatory reporting of use of force and whistleblower protections, I think, are important. So you have consistency and you have integrity built into the system so somebody's not afraid to step forward. I think we have those there now, but I think we really need to reinforce those. Personnel files for law enforcement, that they be open. So you just can't move one officer from one place to another that's had issues. You know, those files have to be open so that if they're going to be considered by another department, that they get all the facts of, you know, what those concerns might be. Oriented policing, community-oriented policing. This is our thought is to provide $600,000 in grant funding to smaller communities to be able to initiate community-oriented policing. And this is something that we started here in Racine back in 1993. Our chief went away to a conference someplace and came back just walking 2 feet off the ground because he thought that this was just the answer to a lot of our problems that we had in our community. And so we initiated it in one of our worst neighborhoods, and where they had drugs and thugs and everything else going on, and the people that lived there were the captives of these thugs and drug dealers. Well, we moved in, bought one of the houses that was, you know, dilapidated and ready to go, and they rebuilt it. Habitat for Humanity stepped in. We got the community involved, and that became the area police house. And so an officer worked directly at the house, responsible for maybe a 10 or 15 block radius, and that became his precinct. And he worked with those people to help them regain control of their own neighborhood. And we started with one in 1993, and I believe we have six right now that are in process here in Racine. I think we've closed two or three and sold those houses that were rebuilt because they took that neighborhood back. And then the money from that went back into buying another home and another seedy part of the community. And so what ended up happening is it's all about getting the trust of the community and having the community be engaged in what the goal is, and that's to take back your own community so that, you know, you're kind of self-policing and people have the feeling that they're part of the process. They're not just an occupying force. And so often officers, when they respond to these really negative calls for service, that's what officers are doing. They're responding to things after the fact. Well, this starts at the beginning of the process and helps the people get connected to the right resources, and that's what this cop house does then. It becomes the center hub of that part of those people's universe so that they can be engaged in solving a lot of their own problems and helping to make them be successful. And that's what law enforcement's about, making things successful and being a good problem solver. It's not how many people you arrest. It's about helping people problem solve, and this is one way to do it, and it's one way to get workforce development involved, get early prison release involved, get mental health involved, get school tutoring involved. I mean, this all happens out of that one COP house. It's a gathering point for those people in that neighborhood, so we're hoping that that's going to come to fruition, too.
We're talking to Republican State Senator Van Mongert about the eight policing-related bills he's introduced in the state legislature, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see change when it comes to policing, local level or statewide? What do you think of this incident review board, in effect, that would look at police-involved shootings and other uses of force by police, review it, try to learn from it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Republican State Senator Van Mongert, who represents Racine and Kenosha counties. We're looking at the package of bills he introduced that deal with policing issues in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Hi. I think that it's probably a Band-Aid situation, the way it looks. But any idea is good. As long as they, you know, people get nervous and stuff about bills and stuff, they can always be changed. So any idea is good as long as, you know, people can accept it like that. But, you know, the problem is that I think in the school system, like in the black community, it's an emergency. It's been an emergency for 40, 50 or plus years. These kids need the state-of-the-art schooling and this and that.
Dan, I gotcha. I want to jump in because I want to get some more callers, too. Dan says he likes to see something here. He's worried it's a Band-Aid and maybe better schools would help, Senator Mongert.
Well, I'm not going to argue that better schools and I think educating our communities to be patient. When you have a situation occur, part of the problem today, as I see it, and having started as police officer in 1972, before we had all this smartphones and instantaneous communication, the problem is that oftentimes people jump to conclusions not having all the information, and this is a really big challenge. And you don't know what information is actually good information. If you don't have good information, that becomes a real huge issue. So getting everybody on the same page, taking time out, take a deep breath, watch the process work. And that's why it's so important to me, having been an investigator for 25 of my 30 years on the Racine Police Department, a process that you go through any investigation is important. If you skip one step, now you've got the potential of not having the result at the end that should be coming out. Because you want it to be a fair result, and if you got a good process, you're going to get a better result if you've allowed it to work. And so I think that the educational part of it is huge, and making sure that all the information is put out there, and we don't jump to conclusions before all the information's in.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Rick now in St. Croix County. Rick, hi.
Yes, you know, all of a sudden you say you want these police officers to be able to diagnose drugs. Well, the doctors can't even diagnose somebody that's on fentanyl or some of these drugs. Our police, for the most part, do a very good job. Times that problems happen, most of the time it's because the person caused some of their own problems.
Rick, thanks for the call. To his first point there, people have said, yeah, we ask a lot of police officers, ask them to identify addiction, be social workers, mental health workers. I don't know, what kind of training do you see Senator Wongard being needed for police officers dealing with all those different situations, or do other professionals need to be involved in responding to some of these incidents?
That is an absolutely great question. I was involved in alcohol and drug rehab things from the time I got on it. Well, actually, from just before I got on the police department, working with some of our local organizations here with kids. And when I got on the police department, I got into the training aspect of it as an accident reconstructionist and a traffic investigator. It was part of my responsibility to teach about one drug, which was alcohol, and train officers on looking at determining what type of saturation level a person had in their system through the HGN-SFST. Horizontal gaze, nystagmus, standardized field sobriety testing. But there's another program that the state's been teaching for probably 30 years, and that's DRE, the drug recognition program. And it helps the officers know whether a person is on alcohol or on other things, amphetamines, uppers, downers. I mean, you can tell from the training, you know, just from their reactions of their eyes, whether they are at a pinpoint or dilated. All those different things that will trip the officer's sense of, oh, wait a minute, we've got to go someplace farther here. There's more going on here than just alcohol or nothing or just drugs. So there are these programs that have been being trained in the different departments, but it's really important that we allow the departments to do the training and we have the amount of dollars and resources in place so these guys can get the training. We are really blessed here in Wisconsin. Our Bureau of Training and Standards, they are phenomenal. They're ahead of the game here from most of our states around the country. They do a great job with bringing training aspects and bringing, I think, a better understanding of some of the needs of officers on the street. We can always use more, and we always need more depth. I think, in part, our guys really do a pretty darn good job. But it's an on-the-job thing. I mean, you're learning this as you're going along and you're responding to people on the street and the changes in how these drugs get into our communities and how saturated they are in our communities. I mean, it used to be when I came on, we had brown heroin coming up from across the Mexican border, and it was about 3 or 4% pure. The stuff they have now is white heroin, and it's about 96 or 97% pure. And fentanyl is, you know, 100 times more powerful than the heroin. So, I mean, these things are transitioning, and we got to stay ahead of the game. And it's an all hands on deck situation where we need our mental health people, we need our doctors, we need our teachers and our educators to be on board, so they understand the implication of drugs in our society. I mean, my goodness, we're saying it's okay to smoke marijuana and everything else, and that's all okay. And to me, that's a gateway, and that causes other problems. That's probably another show we could do with that. But I have to say this, is that it can really lead to some real difficulties. Back in my day, they put PCP on the marijuana, so it would entice that person that's buying it to buy more because they get a really good high. Well, let me tell you, Guess what they're using today? They're dusting it with fentanyl. So these are the problems that we got to deal with, and people got to wake up to this issue today.
Briefly, in our last few moments, we do have a caller. We don't have time for him saying, hey, maybe we need to end the war on drugs. That's going to solve some of these problems. If there's a legally, for example, regulated marijuana industry, it would solve some of the problems you were just laying out. Do we need to change our attitude toward drugs as more of a treatment thing than a law enforcement thing, just in our last minute or so?
Yep, nope, I do not agree with that. I don't think that by allowing more people to have it, something that's illegal, and that we have learned with some of the studies that have been done, and there's some really lengthy studies that have been done over a 20 or 30-year period, that they found that marijuana, as an example, is not something that helps somebody. It causes psychosis, and it causes a lot of schizophrenia, et cetera. And so to add that, so now we have more people out there like that, we make it okay. I sure wouldn't want my grandchildren to be indulging in that, with the potential of them having psychotic episodes, et cetera. That makes absolutely no sense. I mean, this was the thought when they brought oxycodone and those things in, and people used that and ate all that stuff like it was candy. That's what's gotten us to the point where we're at now. So creating more of it, making it legal for more, that is not going to help us become a better society, in my view.
Senator Wongard, thanks for joining us again today.
Rob, you are welcome. Always a pleasure.
That's Van Wongard, Republican representing the state's 21st Senate District, which includes Racine and Kenosha counties. He talked with us about a series of policing-related bills he introduced in the state legislature last week. Coming up after the news, if you've been sleeping badly during the pandemic, you're not alone. We'll find out how COVID-19 has impacted sleep and how we can get some better rest. You can actually get the conversation started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you've experienced maybe new sleep problems over the last year or so. And if you found solutions, we'd love to share them. Again, that's on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent continues a series of interviews with the candidates for the state's top education job in this month's primary election. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the word insomnia was Googled more in 2020 than ever before. That's according to data from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Some experts have even created the term COVID-somnia or Coronasonia. Things like disrupted daily routines and missing out on hobbies or socialization can take a big toll, it turns out, on our sleep quality. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found it more difficult to get to sleep or stay asleep recently? Have your sleep patterns changed or felt disrupted? What has helped you get a better night's sleep? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Plant is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and medical director of Wisconsin Sleep and the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, have you been seeing this and hearing this in your own practice, in your own community, people having trouble sleeping over the last year?
I mean, I think for sure that it's been a growing epidemic along with COVID-19. And, you know, COVID-19 has really affected so many different parts of all of our lives. And so it makes some sense that it's going to affect our sleep, since we spend a third of our lives actually sleeping.
What kind of things, I guess, are predictable here? Right? We're disrupting our schedules. We're disrupting our routines. That it makes sense that that might disrupt the sleep part of our schedules, too, right?
Absolutely, Rob. I mean, we're very much creatures of habit, and our sleep-wake patterns really rely quite a bit on sort of these cues that we have all day long that really have been disrupted by COVID-19. So the time that we normally wake up to go to work, The time that we normally eat meals, the times that we socialize and do certain things, really everything's kind of been jumbled together. So it can be very difficult for people to have a good consolidated night of sleep.
And let's throw stress into the mix. People worried about getting the disease, their loved ones catching it, the economic damage. Am I going to lose a job? That kind of thing. Stress, I imagine, isn't going to make things any better for our sleep.
Absolutely. So insomnia, we know, is worsened by stress. And when you have a lot to worry about or a lot on your mind, it can be very difficult to be able to allow yourself to fall asleep.
There's also been a blurring of the boundaries between work and home. I mean, some people have worked from home always. More of them are doing it now. Does the fact that more people are doing more of their jobs in the place where they live and sleep, does that throw people off?
Yes, I would definitely say that when people lose their boundaries between home and work, that can be very difficult. And a lot of times when those boundaries break down, it's not just in the time that we do the work, it's where we do the work in our home. For example, a lot of people, especially if there's a lot of folks in the house, may try to find a place like in the bedroom where they start, you know, doing their emailing and their day-to-day work. And then they can find it very difficult to wind down and sleep because they've actually turned the bed into their home office, so to speak. So a lot of things can happen.
How do we know to draw the line between, okay, occasionally I have a bad night of sleep, no big deal, and yeah, this is a problem that I maybe should try to tackle?
Well, I think the biggest thing for people to keep in mind is how their sleep is impacting them during the day and their functioning. So, you know, it is very common, like you had said, for people to have an occasional night of insomnia. I think everyone at some point in time has had difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep. But when you start to notice it more regularly, it becomes more of the rule than the exception. And then also if you start to notice that, you know, maybe you're more impaired during the day, your concentration is worse, you're having more headaches, you're more fatigued, those types of things, then it may be time to do something about it.
Talking to David Plant from UW-Madison, assistant professor of psychiatry there. He's with the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. We're talking about how our sleep has been disrupted over the year of the pandemic and what we can do about it. You can join in with your experiences, your own solutions, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. So, David, some people have a lot of experience dealing with their sleep problems. For those people who are new to this, what kind of recommendations would you have for them, the basics of sleep hygiene that they can start to tackle?
Sure. So I think what's really helpful, especially if you have a new problem with sleeping that started since the pandemic, is to try to take a step back and think about, you know, what might have changed since, you know, the start of COVID-19. So, you know, are you working from home? And if so, how has your schedule changed or your work life changed? Are you sleeping in later? Are you working in your bedroom? Have you started to or stop doing things that you used to do, like exercise regularly at a specific time or those types of things? And try to think, you know, what's changed now, because you can oftentimes pinpoint what might be worth sort of zeroing in on from a treatment or a sleep hygiene standpoint. You know, one thing we always recommend is trying to keep a regular wake time, broadly speaking, 7 days a week. A lot of times that can sort of fall by the wayside during the pandemic. We also recommend things like avoiding too much alcohol before bed. We know that there's been a rise in alcohol consumption as well, which can actually disrupt the quality of your sleep. We also recommend trying to get exercise, not too close to bed, because that can make it hard, but exercise certainly helps quite a bit. And we've noticed a decrease in a lot of people's physical activity since they're kind of hold up at home. So there's a lot of things that we would do, but I would say those are some good basic starting points.
We've already gotten some emails and Facebook comments from our listeners. Cassandra emailed to say for her, it's easier to sleep after feeling productive, but that usually means using a computer. Cassandra asks, how bad is, you know, the blue light from computer screens and other screens before sleeping?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So we have in our body something called a circadian rhythm, which you can think of as an internal metronome. It's a drive to be awake that goes up and down every 24 hours. And light is the thing that tells that circadian rhythm what time of day it is. So blue light in particular is the frequency of the visible spectrum of light that shifts or affects that rhythm. So a lot of the screens that we have, computer screens, for example, emit a lot of blue light and can really kind of trick our bodies into thinking that it's daytime, when in fact it's nighttime. So I think what Cassandra is getting at is that, you know, if you get too much blue light exposure before you go to bed, it can actually make it harder to fall asleep. In her case, it sounds like being productive allows her to, I don't know, maybe feel that she's calm enough to allow herself to fall asleep. But generally speaking, we try to avoid too much blue light or screen time before bed, especially if you're having trouble falling asleep. And there are also newer computers, they're in their operating systems, will often have a blue light reduction. And you can even get either blue light blocking goggles or screen covers sometimes if it's a real problem for you.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I have a sleep disorder, so I've always had to work really well on my sleep hygiene to minimize the effects of the disorder. And one of the biggest things that I've noticed in an app that I use for tracking my sleep is I get deeper sleep and better sleep when I stop eating 3 to 4 hours before bedtime. My heart rate ends up getting lower, and I get a nice, much more restful sleep. My body's not having to digest food and go through those processes. It can just get off to sleep.
Interesting, Lisa. Thank you for sharing that. And I have heard this, David. Is that, you know, unique to Lisa, or is that a thing?
No, it's certainly a thing. I think the data and clinical experience is a little bit varied. I'd assume that Lisa is talking about maybe an app that's attached to a fitness tracker, so something like a Fitbit or something like that that's helping her to keep track of her sleep. You know, certainly we don't recommend people eating large meals before they go to sleep, because usually you don't want to have a lot of food in your stomach or your digestive tract, because that can make it a little bit harder to sleep. You know, sometimes if people are feeling hungry, we can recommend a very light snack before they go to bed. That sometimes is helpful, but certainly avoiding large meals too close to bedtime. So, you know, what Lisa's experienced in terms of finding that if she eats too close to bedtime or even 3 or 4 hours before, it sounds like her sleep isn't as good quality. So if that's something you've noticed or a pattern that you've picked up on, you know, certainly I would encourage, you know, keep on doing that type of thing. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of people can do on their own when they're trying to figure out what might make their sleep better for them.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. Now, when is it time to say, hey, this is bad enough and I'm not able to solve it on my own? When should people be talking maybe to their doctor or a sleep lab or something like that when they're having sleep trouble?
Well, usually, I mean, because insomnia is such a common problem, we don't recommend going straight to the sleep center. Usually talking to your doctor is like your regular primary care provider is a good place to start. And I would say, again, when you start noticing that it becomes more the you know, the rule than the exception, when you start noticing that you're having more problems during the day because you know, you're not sleeping well at night. And also when it starts to impact you and your loved ones, if you notice that you're just much more irritable, you're not yourself, you know, it's certainly worth sort of getting attention, because there are lots of ways to treat insomnia that can be quite effective.
We're talking to David Plant, professor of psychiatry and director of Wisconsin Sleep and the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. We're looking at disrupted sleep during the pandemic and what we can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a problem sleeping, especially over the last year? Maybe new problems sleeping. What happened? What do you think caused it? Did you find solutions? And do you have questions about how all this sleep stuff works anyway? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with David Plant, assistant professor of psychiatry at the UW-Madison, medical director of Wisconsin Sleep and the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. You can join in as we talk about sleep problems, especially in the pandemic year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Luke posted on Facebook, he says going to sleep initially is easy for him, but going back to sleep after waking up in the middle of the night is always a challenge. He says a quiet room doesn't help. Maybe putting on a nature show he could simply watch without having to follow works for him. Let's talk about, first of all, the basic problem. Falls asleep okay, can't go back to sleep if he wakes up. Is this a common type of, I guess, insomnia?
Absolutely. So insomnia, it can basically be defined as difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep despite adequate opportunity to sleep. So certainly difficulty sleeping through the night is a very common problem.
And are there particular solutions for that falling back asleep issue as opposed to the initial falling asleep problem?
Well, there's a lot of different things that can cause or contribute to insomnia, so it really varies from person to person. And I can't really say from the caller of the Facebook post exactly what may be going on, but generally speaking, sometimes what happens is people wake up in the middle of the night, and then they may start to do things that actually make it harder for them to fall back to sleep. So sometimes they'll spend a lot of time in bed, for example, struggling to fall back asleep and start getting frustrated. They'll start looking at the clock, which will also make them more frustrated and sort of continue the problem. So oftentimes what we'll recommend is, much like I think the Facebook post was saying, is they kind of get up, go to another room and do some quiet, boring activity, you know, watching a TV program in low light that maybe isn't that exciting, until people start to feel their eyes getting heavy again, and then going back to the bedroom and trying to go back to sleep. Because what can happen is, if we spend a lot of time in bed struggling to sleep, either in the middle of the night or even at the beginning of the night, our mind and our brain can start to pair the bed and the bedroom as a place that we struggle to sleep rather than a place that we do sleep. So those are some general recommendations we like to give people if they're having trouble sleeping through the night or with middle of the night awakenings.
You described me pretty well there. I will sometimes do the angrily, stubbornly, like make myself try to fall asleep, glancing at the clock occasionally. One of my solutions is to have some boring
turning around
books.
That clock is a good place to start for sure for just about everyone, because what I tell my patients is you don't need to know that it's 3 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't do you any good to know the time. So you can still use an alarm, but you don't need to look at the clock all night. That can be a real trigger for people.
That's good information for me. Let's go back to our callers now. Tammy is with us in Mason. Tammy, hi.
Yes, hello. And that last talker that you talked to, he said everything that I've been doing. I turn clocks around, anything. I move to different rooms. But I only can fall asleep when I have just a tiny bit to eat, but then I'm up and I can't get back to sleep. And I've been going through this for like 15 years.
Ooh. Was there anything that changed in your life, Tammy, that that kind of started your sleep difficulty?
Well, all my children were preemies, so I had to wake up every 3 hours to feed them. But now they're 15 and 14, and I'm still in the same thing. Same routine, and so I get out of the bed, and I have a little bit to eat. Once I eat, I can sleep for a couple hours, but then I'm wide awake again, and I get so exhausted. I'm 53 now.
Wow. Well, Tammy, thank you for sharing your story, and good luck to you. Now, we won't ask you to diagnose Tammy in particular, but for that thing where, as in her case, we've been forced to live in a certain sleeping schedule, in this case up every 3 hours with premature children. How can we get ourselves back out of routine once we've locked into it? A bad routine, I should say, once we've locked into it, David.
Right. So, it depends. There's a lot of different ways. I mean, behavioral change is hard, for a lot of different areas of our health. So I think the first step is to try to take stock in what's happening. So sometimes people can take sleep diaries or sleep logs that are they're available on the internet, just to kind of write down what time they're going to bed, what time they're waking up, and certain patterns that come up. And we use these a lot clinically to try to get a sense of what's going on over time. That they can be really helpful, because a lot of times we have this tendency to remember our worst nights as well. So sometimes it may not be quite as bad when you sort of look at the long-term picture. Sometimes people have trouble doing those kinds of things and need an additional person to kind of take a look at it and walk them through that. So that's where sometimes getting your primary care provider involved, or even seeing a sleep medicine specialist. There's a whole area of sleep medicine called behavioral sleep medicine that I sort of describe it to patients as sort of like having a personal trainer for your sleep, where you go into really a lot of detail about what your sleep patterns look like and ways that you can try to straighten it out. So there's lots of different ways, but I think the first place to start is to try to take a look at what you're doing and take it apart from there.
Good luck to you, Tammy. Let's go to Mary now in Chippewa Falls. Mary, hi.
Hi. Hey. This is a little confusing for me, because all of the people that I'm related to genetically have always not really had a schedule. I mean, my mom and dad, my brothers, and I just And me too. We seem to be night owls, and of course that's difficult to do sometimes. But you could call my house in the middle of the night and somebody would be awake and answer the phone immediately. So I when my kids were little, yeah, I got them to school and everything, but it still didn't change. And I always go back to the, you know, maybe not, it's not really a night owl either, because it's kind of no schedule at all is what it really is.
But Mary, and do you feel like you end up getting enough sleep on that weird schedule?
As long as I'm in charge of it, sure. But I don't know. Is there some reason for health that I should try to change?
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Okay, so I think it sounds like, David, she's getting enough sleep, but not on the, 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. or whatever schedule. If it ain't broke, should she try to fix it?
Well, I think in general, if it isn't broke, don't try to fix it when it comes to your sleep. People are different and they have sort of different tendencies, especially, the caller had alluded to being a bit of a night owl. So what that means is that circadian rhythm that I was talking about earlier, that drive for alertness that goes up and down every 24 hours, that internal metronome, in some people, in the majority of people, it sort of has typical hours where, the usual sleep period will be somewhere around 10 p.m. to somewhere around, 6 a.m. or so, ballpark. But the reality is people can be on either side of that. And if people are night owls, they tend to want to go to bed later and wake up later. It's what we call a delayed sleep phase. And then there are also larks, morning people who like to go to bed early and wake up early as well. So that's just people's kind of normal natural tendencies. And if it's not a bother to the person, and if their schedule allows them to do that, then certainly it's not a problem. What we'll often see in sleep clinic is when people, especially if they have a delayed sleep phase, these extreme night owls, for example, they start running into problems because they're late for school or work or those kinds of things. So, I think that may be what's going on or that the caller was alluding to, but it's hard to say for sure.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Courtney is with us in Appleton. Courtney, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to ask about?
So kind of like the previous caller, I guess I have trouble. I work typically until around 10 p.m., and I have a hard time falling asleep after that, until anywhere between 12 a.m. and 2 a.m. But, then I lead to sleeping in the next day, and my husband works a normal, 7 to 3, so he's up early, and I guess I'm just recommendations for how I can get myself to kind of mentally calm down.
Courtney, thanks a lot for that call. We just have a minute or so left, David. Any thoughts on how to get from work to sleep and maybe a little faster?
Well, what I'd say is what that does sound like is a common problem called, shift work to a certain degree, where when we have to work at different times, it makes it difficult for us to sleep sort of under a normal pattern. And what the caller is describing is very common, where, they've been at work, especially if they have a high stress job, for example, and they get home and then they need that wind down time, and it's difficult to do. Sometimes if you can find ways to wind down quickly by giving yourself a sort of space to relax, but then also maybe try to do some of the things you normally do right before bed ahead of time, so you don't have to worry about them quite as much. That may be a little bit easier to allow yourself to fall asleep a little bit faster or earlier.
Hope that helps, Courtney. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
David Plant is an assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison and medical director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. He joined us for a look at sleep problems, especially ones people are experiencing during the pandemic. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, from the Paris Accord to pipeline plans and more, the Biden administration has tackled environmental issues in its first weeks on the job. We'll break down some of the big stories and you can share your thoughts. And the pandemic has put the category of casual friendships on hold. Our guest says that's a problem. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. On Food Friday last week, Chris Kimball from Milk Street Kitchen helped us to be more frugal and cut down on kitchen waste, in part by figuring out how to use milk and other dairy products before they go bad. We've got some great recipes he shared at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you called in with some of your favorites and told us about the hazards of drinking milk straight out of the carton. One big lesson, if you're going to do it, smell that carton first. We also heard from some of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page with your recipes to use up a bunch of milk before it turns. Karen says, I'm using some of mine for tonight's dinner, salmon patties with creamed peas. This is pretty yummy. Megan says, pudding with mango sauce. My kid's favorite, no raisins. And Liz says she likes to use up milk in baked custard. And I do things like that I mentioned on the show, bread pudding, which uses a custard, or a strata, or quiche, that kind of thing. And in the interest of frugality, I've been big on, this is not a milk thing, bagel chips lately. Up to a year ago, my kids, I ate so many bagels, I stacked them in the grocery store like cordwood in my arms and then dumped them into the grocery cart. And then they stopped. And so we had this freezer full of bagels, slowly freezer burning. I've become the expert at making bagel chips. Just finished a batch today. Let us know your favorite food frugality measure. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.